This is Frank Collada, and you are listening to Gangland Wire. And if you're ever in Vegas, take the Frank Collada Casino Tour, 702-622-0850. Thank you.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire, creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Welcome back, folks. Welcome to the classic Ice House building right here in Midtown Kansas City. We're in the studio, Studio 4 of the Big Dumb Fun Show. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, Aaron, you know, we've just gone through kind of a heated election. Have you noticed anything in the newspapers about some kind of an election recently?
I did.
You did? Okay.
Depends on when you release this actual episode, but I think even if you released it tomorrow.
Well, sometime in the last 6 months, yeah. We've had an election, haven't we?
I think there's probably 6 or 7 episodes that you haven't heard by the time you've heard this.
It might be.
And there'll be 6 or 7 more that will be waiting to be released.
So you can tell how long it is before we, between the time we
record,
tape an episode or record an episode and release it. But moving right along.
Hopefully those facts have not changed in the intervening time.
Right.
Donald Trump did win the election.
Yeah, he actually ends up being the president. We don't know right now, do we?
The Electoral College may have met at this point.
Yeah, and there's a bunch of protesters out there that might create a rebellion and just take over the government by force. What
I think
do you
they're just waiting for the cold to set in, much like the protesters aren't doing as much protesting when it's cold out. Here's the thing what you need to do. If you love politics and you love true crime, you need to go out and on YouTube, there's a hour-long special that Gary Jenkins and I did with Terrence O'Malley, who is the author of the documentary Black Hand Straw Man, which has a book copy compendium, and Harry and Tom, which is another great documentary about Harry Truman and Tom Pendergast. And that hour-long special we did as a live remote over at the Uptown Arts Bar, what would have been election time a year ago. And if you love mob and you love the politics and you love to find out what's going on in the history of that, check that out.
Yeah, that goes back into the 30s. Mm-hmm. But more recently, in more recent times, you know, the talking about the FBI and the mob, you know, we had some controversy stirred up during this pre-election time when the FBI director, James Comey, announced that he was going to reopen an investigation against one of the candidates. And then shortly after, he said he was going to close it again and that it would remain the same, that they weren't going to charge her with anything. It created a whole lot of drama. And in the middle of that drama, there was a particular person, Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid, attacked FBI Director Comey in late October for his handling of this investigation. And, you know, that kind of stirs me thinking, you know, and the all those wiretaps I got for the casino skimming trials and for my movie Gangland Wire, there was a lot of references to a man that they codenamed Clean Face. And the Clean Face was their code for Harry Reid, who was the, I believe it was the president or the director. He was the head of the gaming commission? Control board. What?
Or was it the commissioner?
He was the head of the gaming control board.
Okay, in Nevada.
During that time in Nevada. And he had a lot to do with the hearings in regards to particularly Lefty Rosenthal, who was the Robert De Niro character in the movie Casino. So I thought we ought to go back and investigate that, and I took a look at a lot of those wiretaps and found several of them that had the term clean face in it. And tonight we have, you know, like those mob guys say, this is a friend of ours. That means that he's a connected guy. Mm-hmm. Well, tonight we have a friend of ours, retired FBI Special Agent Bill Owsley, who's going to be able to help us with this investigation of Harry Reid and Clean Face and what the deal was behind that story, because there's always a story behind the story, and we get it from the mouths of the people who lived it. And he's a guy that lived it because he was a supervising agent over that entire case. Welcome back, Bill.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here again.
Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
Now, Bill also has a couple of books, if we didn't mention this before, Mobsters in Our Midst and Open City.
Right. Bill, tell us a little bit about your two books. Start with Open City. What's the subject there?
Well, Open City really traces the origins of the Kansas City crime family from the period of the Black Hand in the 1900s all the way up to 1950. It also would give the reader quite a bit of insight into the politics of Truman, Pendergast, the mob in those the era of the Prohibition, the 30s and 40s. And so it's a historical tracing of how our crime family here in Kansas City developed.
And then Mobsters in Our Midst.
So Mobsters in Our Midst would take up from the 1950s when Nicholas Civella became the boss of the family and covered his 30-year reign as boss, concluding with the downfall of the family due to the enormous case called the Straw Man case, which involved the infiltration of Las Vegas casinos by the mob using Teamster funds and their skimming of millions of dollars from those casinos.
You know, and speaking of like the Kansas City mob and politics, we have a long tradition of that going back into the 30s. They were hand in glove with the Pendergast machine. John Lazia was the kind of the mob boss, and he Pendergast, part of the Pendergast faction, and he was actually given a office on police headquarters right down the hall from the chief of police at some one period of time. We even found a document that came out of the chief's office at some point in time that had they were doing a hire and talking about hiring somebody for the police department. Down below, it had written "Okay, John Lazia." So we have a long history of that in Kansas City, and even up till when I first came on the police department, there was a couple of judges still left back from the old days that were obviously appointed out of the old Pendergast machine. They probably retired by the middle 70s, if I remember right. But we still had some the last vestiges of that in Jackson County, Missouri.
I was going to say your background in terms of being an author and an expert of this. Of this topic is that you've spent 20 years in the service, right?
Yeah.
You were for the Kansas City FBI field office. We did some notes beforehand where you're the organized crime squad supervisor at the time of your retirement.
That's right. Yes.
What were the years of those of service?
I retired in 1985. So going back 22 years, that was my time in Kansas City. I had a total of 25 years service when I retired. But
basically from 73 to 85.
Yeah, right.
Which was in the heart of all of this going on with the casinos.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was.
Were you sent here because of that?
Yeah. I had put in for an organized crime squad, organized crime work. Turned out this office was available, and I ended up here. Actually, I ended up here in 65, that's when I started my career. So I was pretty much within a few years of the beginning of the organized crime program, which followed the Appalachian Gangland Convention when Hoover instituted the program. So I had the early years when Civella sort of had the run of the mill. We didn't have the laws or the tools. And then during the 70s, the River Key, the violence, the upstart Carl Sparrow, and that violent era, and then led us into that straw man case, which took up about 7 years. Well, 5 or 7 years. And I retired after that.
And sometime during this course of your career here in Kansas City, you ran across a young, talented crime-fighting officer.
Named Gary Jenkins.
Well, you know, part and parcel of what I did and a lot of other agents who realized the asset that they were, I spent a lot of time at the intelligence unit. When I came here, pretty unwashed behind the ears, I was from New York City, so I knew about organized crime. They were in the neighborhood. But, you know, the ins and outs was something else. And there were a couple of early on intelligence unit guys, Ray Kenny and Jimmy Doolin, and me and a partner who came here together, sort of went to school with these people. And I became extremely close with that unit throughout my career.
And then I came along and learned everything I could learn from Ray Kenny myself.
Yeah.
We're going to do a whole show about that, those early days of the intelligence unit and the FBI and the Top Hoodlum program.
Yeah, it's a story.
Pretty soon it is. It's a great story. And particularly Ray Kenny is such an interesting guy. And he was truly a unique person. But moving right along.
But that was the beginnings of the intelligence unit.
Right, right. We want to do a whole show on that. It's called the Top Hoodlum Program, and they went to work with the intelligence units of all over the United States. Most major cities had an intelligence unit, and they were the few people many times in that police department that the FBI felt like they could trust in the 50s and 60s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those units, because of the nature of organized crime and its institutional connection with politics. That's one thing about the American mafia, the Cosa Nostra. When people ask me, what is the biggest asset for organized crime in that field, the Italians? It's not the gun. It's not the machine gun. It's politics. And that comes from their roots in Sicily, where they were tied into the political political establishment. So, that being known, as Gary said, the vestiges were still in many cities. Chicago, I don't know if ever got over it. Intelligence unit officers were usually handpicked and were the top of the top and as to integrity and trustworthiness.
And you know, even in Kansas City up until we did a show about Nick Savelle and the Teamsters, and I don't remember if this was in Mobsters in Our Midst or not. It would have been during that time frame. Nick Savella first met Roy Lee Williams, who went on to be the president of the International Teamsters Union and, you know, helped them obtain all these huge loans for Las Vegas casinos to set up the skim. He met him while they were both serving on a Democratic Party nominating committee. So there was the mob boss of Kansas City sitting on the committee of the Democratic Party, and the Democratic Party had every office in Jackson County and the city at that point in time. You know, they picked who ran for office. So that's how powerful they were, and that was clear up into, I'd say, the early 60s maybe.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I have that in my book, and that is how we met him politically, not that's where that relationship began. And and during that period, they were still extremely involved in politics, up and down the line, state, local. It was still a powerful asset in their arsenal.
So moving on to the Strawman case, and if you guys seen my movie Gangland Wire, if you haven't, go out and rent it right away. You can get it for $1.99 at Amazon.com,
Or you can watch buy it.
Or you can buy it from me too. I make a little more money.
Yeah, and you can own it.
Or if you want a DVD, you go to my website, and I make a little more money, and you get a DVD. You know, I'll mail it right out to you, $20.
Autographed copy.
Yeah. I'll even throw in a little extras that I've got.
You almost need like a little Gangland Wire, like, you know, a piece of paper. You go, hey, thank you very much for the donation. Barry Jenkins.
Yeah, well, I've got something exactly like that that is like a little postcard that has some cool artwork on it. Anyhow, moving right along, you know, that was a story about the FBI investigating skim coming out of two different Las Vegas casinos in particular, the Stardust and the Tropicana. Now, gaming industry, at that point in time, I believe Atlantic City had started, but it was really in its infancy, and the majority of all gaming was in Las Vegas, Nevada. Everybody in the United States went to Las Vegas, Nevada. It was huge. It was the only place for legalized casino gaming, and they had the book back then, too, didn't they, and sports betting, too. So it was the only place you could do that legally. Now, in the gaming industry, I worked in the gaming industry in Missouri. Right after I started practicing law, I was an arbitrator between employees who were in trouble, who had their license challenged for some individual activity that they had done. If they wanted to appeal to the board, they had to go to a hearing and put on a case in front of me, the arbitrator, and then I would make a recommendation to the board as to whether the punishment they had been given by the professional staff that was employed by the board was legitimate or appropriate or not. And I noticed that there are so many rules and regulations. These companies anymore, they can't bend over and take a fart without maybe violating some kind of a regulation. We once had a kid accidentally. He was a short kid that the parents should have never tried to walk into the casino with him. But the way the choke point was set up, this kid was only about 3 foot high, and the gaming employee was behind a podium, and they were supposed to check their cards as they came in. At that point in time, you had a little card that you showed to get into the casino. And the little kid walked up with the parent and then walked on by and stepped on an escalator and went down on the gaming floor. And I had the video, and the gaming security was alerted immediately. By the time this kid got to the bottom of the escalator on the gaming floor, there was about four security guards. You could see them on the different camera angles were running to grab this kid up and grab him up. And the parents came down about that time, and they all, you know, take them all off back into a back room. And they're also supposed to be self-reporting, and there's always a highway patrolman assigned to every casino, and they look at things like that. So the Gaming Commission filed a charge against him for allowing an underage person down on the floor. And they find the dog shit out of him. They find him, I want to say, $100,000. I was kind of surprised. And so then they appealed it, and they came to me, and I thought it was a little bit egregious, a little bit high, the fine. It was more like an accident. But the deal was they want to keep such a rigid control that they said the gaming, the casino company was negligent because they could either had two people at this choke point because they had people lining up. At that point in time, they had them lining up. And they knew at certain times of the day they would have people lining up to get in. And so the checker at the choke point was overwhelmed with people. And so he did. So if they'd had two people there, the kid wouldn't have gone on the gaming floor. Or maybe if the podium wasn't there. And so they had these reasons. This is why we're fine, these guys. And we want them to change this so they can make sure this never happens again. So it's really rigid. Now, back in the 1970s, they weren't quite so rigid as our friend Bill Friedman says that when gaming first started in Las Vegas, they hired mob guys who had been running illegal casinos to come in because they didn't know how to run casinos, and these guys did. And so they really, that's where they really got their start, was helping the local people open and run casinos. Of course, you don't give a mob guy an inch, and he's going to take a mile. And, you know, then they kind of started going a little more in the background.
And people like Harry Reid came along.
Really. And so now we get on to modern times. And when Bill and the FBI are doing this investigation, and they've got all these wiretaps going, and they're listening to people talk, and they're not talking about local things in Kansas City at all. What were they talking about, Bill?
Well, as a bit of back, just a minor background, we had an internal war, so to speak, on the streets, a lot of violence, and we at the FBI had run a microphone in a restaurant hoping to gain evidence of these murder conspiracies. Instead, we picked up Carl DeLuna, who was the street boss, talking with Carl Savella, who was the acting boss. His brother Nick was in jail. And they were discussing events in Las Vegas. The Stardust Hotel was going to be up for ownership. There were varying what they call packages vying for the ownership position so they could skim and get the lion's share of the money. So that's where we came in and began this enormous case called Straw Man. But that was in 1978. Events had been transpiring long before that. So it was like we came in the middle of the movie. That was the beginning. When we started the electronic surveillance, it was like a tsunami in the sense of information and catching up. And the use of code names was throughout this. And as Gary said, there was this code name, Clean Face, subsequently identified as Harry Reid, who was the commissioner of the Gaming Commission. There were two entities. The Gaming Board was sort of the investigative group. They did the backgrounds. They did the investigations. They were like the intelligence unit. Then they would make findings that and recommendations that went to the commission, a five-member board that made the ultimate rulings. So, for example, if the board said Gary Jenkins needs to be licensed as a key employee, meaning he has management responsibilities, that would shoot up to the commission, who would make the ruling based on the hearings as to whether the license should be issued. Reid was appointed that position as the commissioner in January of 1977, was afforded the code name Clean Face.
Now, this is the Harry Reid who goes on to become Senator Harry Reid, correct?
That's what we found out, yes.
You didn't find that out till much later, did you?
Much later, yeah. At the time, he was a functionary of no great importance other than what he could do for the mob.
Yeah.
Well, and he had a lot of power because of his position as on that board with the commission, because that meant the casino either got a gaming license or they didn't.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
I mean, so if you're talking about the transfer of the assets of, I believe, what was the Argent Corp mm-hmm. at the time,
mm-hmm.
They couldn't transfer those, without the authorization and permission, if you will, and approval of the commission.
Yeah, it starts earlier than that. You can't buy a hotel casino unless you pass muster and the commission affords you a gaming license. And then you're under their control forever. You violate something, they call you in. They can fine you. They can do this, that, or the next thing, or take your license. They're the ultimate arbiter.
And then the second position is the key employee position, and that's huge. They have to, you know, you can get a job as a cleanup guy. You can get a job as a busboy. You can get a job as a server.
A dishwasher.
You can get a job as an entertainer. But you can even get a job with minimal kind of background checking and review as a car dealer, a pit boss even. But you get to a certain position where you really influence a lot. You're called a key employee, which I know the way it was in the state of Missouri was they did about three times as much investigation on the key employees and had much higher standards than those other people.
Yeah, everyone in the industry must be afforded a license through the Gaming Commission. The cook and all, they all have to, as you say, go through not as stringent, but they're, yeah. The key employee is anyone that has authority to call any kind of shot. See, a pit boss would be a key employee.
Oh, Woody, I didn't know where it started.
Yeah, it would. If you have authority to hire, to fire, to budget, any of those positions require you are considered a key employee and must be licensed to that higher standard.
So this and this is a politically appointed board by the governor, correct?
Absolutely.
So the not the board, the commission. I'm getting those terms mixed up myself. So the board or is a professional staff, and the commission is a politically appointed body who then votes and makes the final decision.
Right, and I think the director of the board might be appointed, but the board has their regular investigators and regular staff, but the commission is all. Five members are appointed by the incumbent governor.
Okay. So Harry Reid, he was appointed by, I believe, Governor Callahan, who was a Democrat, of course, and Harry Reid's a Democrat. And Bill, in your opinion, is it important for a casino and owners of casinos and people that have interest in casinos to have good relationships with the Gaming Commission?
Well, absolutely. Yeah, they they would. But there also is the necessity to have a hands an arm's length relationship. They can't be, can't be too cozy. There can't be conflicts of interest. As an example, Reid was with a law firm when he was appointed. He had to quit that law firm and open his own little office so that there would never, because most of these attorneys are representing casinos or casino employees. So there has to be an arm's length. He got his own office. But certainly you want to be on the good side of these people's where you can do it and not violate the arm's length requirement.
So as you're listening to these wiretaps, you start hearing this name, Cleanface. Now, I know you heard a lot of different code names, and you started one of your primary investigative objectives would be to identify who these were. Like, for example, the brain or the genius was Alan Glick. Mm-hmm. You figured that out after a while. You don't get it at first, I'm sure, but in the context, through informants, you figure out who these people are, the hunter, I think, was Gustafsson, wasn't he, from owner?
Yeah, yeah.
The joker was one of the Dumani brothers who owned the Tropicana. A car dealer was Joey Cusimano, who was Tony Sparato's buddy. And they only called, I noticed going through those, they only called Sparato T.
Or Little T.
Or Little T, yeah. They didn't, everybody's wanting to give him other nicknames. I noticed the aunt particularly, but he only, Tuffy DeLuna talked to him and asked for him one time. I think he called him T, and they were talking about Little T. And then put him next to, he said, I don't care if it's Cusimano or another one of Little T's buddies, you can't let them get away with something. I don't remember what it was, but. So it all makes sense, but at the time it didn't make sense when you first started hearing these names. Now, Cleanface, you would want to know who Cleanface was, I'm sure. Aaron, here's a play that clip, EX-256. Let's listen to this.
What you're saying, if he makes too many noises now, he's liable to involve other people.
Sure.
By other people, what do you mean, like to Cleanface?
Yes. Oh, definitely. No question about it. But mainly that's one of my major concerns.
Uh-huh. And maybe Channel 1.
He has never, no goddamn business involving those people. If he goes down, he should go down as a man.
Okay, thanks, Aaron. Now, Bill, that's a little clip that you probably heard before. It was used in the trial. It was an exhibit at the trial. That clip was about complaining. Joe Augusto was complaining a lot about Lefty Rosenthal because Lefty Rosenthal was frantically trying to retain the ability to be a key employee in the casino. And then they kicked him out once and he came back in and he said he wasn't a key employee. He was the food and beverage director or something, but he was really running the casino. And then the Gaming Commission started moving on him again. And so then he started kicking up kind of a ruckus. So in that tape, Tuffy asked Joe Augusto, he said, what are you saying? He makes too many noises. Now he's liable to involve other people. you know, like other people like clean face. So what would that mean to you?
What it meant is they were concerned about Lefty Rosenthal's antics in resisting all of the efforts by the gaming board and the commission to get him in and a hearing for licensing, which he knew he wasn't going to get. His answer was to come back at him. He was an aggressive, pugnacious, flamboyant guy who wouldn't take crap from anybody. And now Joe Augusto, who's out there on the scene, is saying, if this guy continues on, he's going to hurt our guy, Clean Face. And that's what they were concerned about. There's collateral damage to what Lefty was doing in not only resisting the board, but throwing insults at Harry Reid.
He also talks about also maybe Channel One. Who was Channel One?
Well, Channel One was an attorney called Jay Brown. Jay Brown and Reid go way back. They became fast friends, families together doing things. Jay Brown, therefore, had the man's ear, so to speak. He had an inside connection to Reid because of their association, and the mob gave him the name Channel, obviously to me, because he was a channel to Reid, and he was also a channel to politicians because he would handle contributions and get them to the right people. If I might interject one thing, because it's important when the defenders of Harry Reid say this is all a bunch of baloney and made up. You know, we use the term code name, and maybe it isn't that significant with code name this, code name that. But in the mob, it was particularly significant. They gave code names to their places and friends and associates for security. Now, one of the things we noticed, which supports Clean Face as Reid, even though it became evident, but what supports it, no other commission member has been discussed by a code name. In fact, very few of them are named at all. They had no importance because they were working with the mob. No other person in the board or the commission had a code name. So to me, that increases the significance that Reid was given a code name indicating he was an important person to the mob.
I agree. I went through all those wiretaps and all the transcripts, and you identified to me, and as I went through them, I'd have to agree with your identification of who each person was, except maybe the Joker. I wasn't sure, but I knew Joker had a brother, and there was a Demani brother, so and so only one of them had a nickname, which I thought was interesting.
I think one was the Joker, and one was the not the lawyer.
Oh, I think you're right.
They had another name.
They hardly referred to him at all, though.
Yeah.
A couple of times they called him the Arabinos, I think, because they were both Arabs. But the one guy that they identified by name that was kind of in that same, that was the Attorney General. They talked about the Attorney General, Bob List, and they called him Bob or List. And they never gave him a code name.
No.
They did not get, they referred to Bob Rose, who was running against Bob List, who was a Democrat running against Bob List for governor that particular year, mm-hmm. and they talked, they talked about Rose, but I think one time they talked about him being Gardenia.
Yeah.
I believe.
Yeah.
But mainly they talked about Rose and Rose's people, because they were frantically trying to make political contributions to Rose, and Rose somehow smelled a rat because he gave them all back, back to Glick and to the Stardust people. So, nothing's ever quite black and white exactly, you know, as you might think it would be.
Yeah, well, one thing to keep in mind, too, with an infrequent term like gardenia, Tuffy and Augusto often talked in Sicilian. And so the word would come up in Sicilian that to Augusto, who maybe didn't think of the name Rose right away, said Gardenia was same thing. But
oh yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah.
So, but the common ones, we could go through all sorts of people in the Vegas area that didn't have code names that were talked about, and so it's a vital part of this thing when Reed wants to duck responsibility. He was given a code name because he was important.
You know, and as an example of that, let's play another little clip here. Aaron, play the one that's titled 12.3 Bugged.
So, is it positive that Lyft was wired?
No.
Is that positive, huh?
No, I want to say so. I want to say, but I am to believe it, and people would receive it, it was a good one. No?
Well,
and also the fact that even according with the Joker, he has known him very well for the past year or so, better than anybody does on me. And he says that, as a matter of fact, they used to call him Bug Robert or something, big name like that, you know.
Like he used to like to use bugs?
Yeah, like he uses bugs just like Nixon used to do.
I see.
So he has that type of reputation.
Wouldn't Frank know that?
I don't know. But his Joker knows about it, because Joker's the one that told me. Now, the guy, he made a firm statement that he was a bug, was an attorney in Reno, you know, which is a senator, which his name is Roger, which is the Joker attorney and Lavin attorney. And and I heard the conversation between this guy, Senator, and Joker, you know, saying Lyft was a bug. So you guys be goddamn careful online, because they are going to use all your lies. If they don't get you for this extortion, they're going to get you for perjury.
Mm-hmm. And imagine if Roger was friends with Loudon.
Well, no, Roger is a friend of Loudon, and also Roger was the campaign manager. He's a Republican, a campaign manager in Reno for Lyft.
Well, I would presume then with you that the lefty knows about it.
Yeah, right. That's what I was assuming.
Okay. All right. Your fear is then that...
My fear here that I don't have no assurance where the stop signs are. You know what I mean, on this guy. A little fact, the reports I've received are very, very close on people to him, including the Joker, and including his brother, and including the Channel One, and including the Queen Face. You know that this guy, they can handle the remark they made, that he's out for the kill, and if he goes down, he's going to take everybody with him. I mean,
now, Bill, in that particular little clip, wiretap, they used a lot of names, and some of them they used the real names, and some of them they used the code names, like Joker, which we've already agreed that's one of the Dumonte brothers, who was one of the owners of the Tropicana, which Joe had his complete confidence. That guy believed that Joe Augusto could run the casino, and Joe could get in, he could get away. He was one of the owners, and he allowed Joe to get away with anything he wanted to get away with, basically to help run that casino when he didn't even have any kind of license. I think Joe was a contractor with the Tropicana. And then he used Lyft. Like I said, he used the word Lyft, the name Lyft, and they used Bug Bob, Bug Roberts, which the guy's name was Bob Lyft. Indicated that he liked to record things. When he says bugged, he's talking about carrying a recorder around. And Lefty had sent a guy to Robert Lyst, the gubernatorial candidate, to try to extort him with a threat, if I remember right, to lay off a Lefty. You remember anything about that particular threat?
Oh, yeah. Well, Lefty was in a dire position. The board was after him for licensing as a key employee. As Lefty was wont to do, reacted by having Bob Brown, who was the editor of one of the local newspapers and in Lefty's pocket, go to Lyst and say to Lyst, we sort of have you compromised. We know you stayed at the Stardust, You were comped, didn't pay a nickel. Then you submitted your voucher and was paid by the state for what you got free. We have it all on paper, but we're ready to make a deal with you. If you were to get off Lefty Rosenthal, help him skid the ways with his licensing, we would be willing to not run this particular story. Now, what this conversation is about is they were afraid that List had recorded all this, that he was, like Nixon, had recording equipment, and now he was going to be in a position to have evidence of an extortion attempt. And he, in fact, did go to the FBI and reported the approach. And so they're concerned about how much evidence there is of this, number one. And then number two, concerned about if Lefty is going to go to this extent, he's, as Augusto said, I don't know what assurances of what the stop signs are. In other words, when are we going to get this guy corralled and stopped? Because, as he says after that, he's going to bring everybody down with him.
And he says, including Channel One and including Clean Face.
And right. And so during this particular era of turmoil with Lefty and the Stardust Hotel, which were key to the mob, they were skimming millions of dollars out of the Stardust, which money went to Chicago and then was distributed from there to Kansas City, Milwaukee, and Cleveland. This was a huge plum for them. And in the midst of this turmoil, the threat of losing the Stardust and the Fremont they owned also, skimming from there, Lefty was making a mess of it. Augusto was trying to tell them, you got to put a stop sign on this guy. And he continues to fight dirty, and he's going to bring Reed down, and that's going to hurt all of us.
You think they were afraid that Lefty and his death throes, if you will, would be flailing around, and then he would have inside information on Harry Reid, some stuff he'd done wrong, and then try to blackmail him, and if that didn't work, then he would, you know, tell the newspapers, put it out in public, and create some kind of investigation on Harry Reid at the time. Was that what they were afraid of?
Well, that was certainly in the mix. I mean, like going to the newspaper, one of his code references was, they called him at times, newspaper, because he wrote columns. He used the newspaper to voice his interests and dislikes, and as did occur down the road, the hearings turned into a bizarre drama between Lefty and Reed and the commission, but mainly Reed. So, they were afraid that during one of these hearings, he might say, you know, I know you as Clean Face and you're dirty. Yeah,
that's right.
Because it was not beyond this guy.
Interesting. Well, you know, we're up probably past our 30-minute limit. Let's go ahead and wind this down, and we will do a second episode in which we will talk about some of the other evidence that retired FBI agent and supervisor of the Organized Crime Squad, Bill Owsley, recovered in the form of notes in Tuffy DeLuna's house. He found some backup. A lot of these conversations, you know, you just can't take a conversation and then have play it for somebody and say, this is what this means. You need some other solid evidence. You need somebody like Joe Augusto to say, this is what this means, or somebody like Angelo Leonardo out of Cleveland, who ended up testifying in some of these trials, to say, this is what this means. And you didn't have Tuffy. He wasn't ever going to say what anything means.
Carl Thomas testified.
He was a
casino executive
with the Tropicana, who was... and at the Stardust, who was intimately involved with the skim from the early days. He had started out skimming at the Circus several years before that with Alan Dorfman, so he knew all the ins and outs. And And so you got to get this. You also was nice. What one thing that Bill ended up finding were notes in Tuffy DeLuna's house that supported some of this stuff. So we're going to talk about that next time and some of the other evidence that they gathered in this case. So that brings me to the point of time when I want to do my public service announcement. If you have a friend, relative, employee, a loved one that has a problem with drugs or alcohol, any kind of addiction, make your first call to First Call, 816-361-5900, or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. And even if you're from out of town, you can give them a call and they can steer you to some resources in your own city. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I've got to say, remember to download the Kansas City Mob Tour app for $1.99. You can take your own self-guided tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City. And then remember to not just rent, but buy the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available on Amazon. Or for a donation of $25 or more to Gangland Wire, Gary will send you an autographed copy of his DVD, Gangland Wire, as long as you live in the United States. If not, we're going to send you some digital samples.
I can send you a link to watch the entire movie.
There you go.
Okay, say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Bill.
Goodnight.
Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.
What you're saying, if he makes too many noises now, he's probably involved. Other people.
Sure.
By other people, you mean like Chick Cleanface?
Yeah. Oh, definitely. No question about it. But mainly that's one of my major concerns.
Uh-huh. And maybe Channel 1.
He has never, no goddamn business involving those people. If he goes down, he should go down as a man.
What do you do for a living?
I invoke my right under the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution and decline to answer the question.